Press play.
Curtain up and now we're in.
It's time to take spin.
The shade and tea to spill.
Ooh, drama. Ooh, that's a tweet. Did they book? Who got nominated?
They option no.
Oh, I'm not well. What star will we talk to today?
Oh, that's a gag, honey.
Say no more. Drama.
Drama. Welcome to Drama, a podcast that covers theater,
pop culture,
love,
and life.
I'm Connor McDowell.
And I am Dylan McDowell. Connor, you know, we're together again.
Again.
And I do want to talk to you because
we're always together.
So much happens, though, that we don't experience together. And then I forget to ask you what you think of certain things.
Yeah.
And one of those things is the movie Nope.
Oh, right, because you saw it. Yes.
Now, I don't know if our guest has seen it or has any interest in seeing it. Okay, but this, of course, is a spoiler-free zone.
Always, so always.
I don't know how one could really spoil the movie other than, you know, there's certain things. What did you think?
I loved it.
Yeah?
I thought it was great. It was the least scary of, like, I thought Us was way scarier.
Oh, yeah.
Us was, like, the scariest movie I've ever seen.
Really?
At the beginning of Us, when the little girl, it's like the flashback to like...
Okay, you just get... I just got like a weird chill, maybe I do agree.
When young Lupita is like at the carnival and gets lost, and then I don't want to give too many spoilers,
then
cut to like the present day storyline in Us when they're at the family like beach house or whatever. I only saw it once, so this is all just me pulling from my memory.
I know.
When they're at the family beach house, and all of a sudden the kid's like, there's a family...
In the driveway.
And I think that was in the trailer, holy shit, that scared the pants off
me. Well, what I loved about that movie was that we saw it opening weekend, and the audience was so invested. You know, everyone really wanted to see it, but there was a creepy guy walking in and out of the theater the whole time, and it wasn't a worker.
That was disturbing. He was probably scared.
He was tethered to something.
Oh my God.
Anyways, Nope. Loved it. I thought it was more of like a Western thriller than like a horror movie.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
I'm still not sold on a plot detail. But I guess I can't say because it's a spoiler.
Yeah.
But it was great. I mean, Kiki Palmer.
It was amazing.
I love her.
Yeah. I thought it was just really, really well written. Like everything I think was intentional to it. Even the whole Gordy thing, which again.
That's where my question comes in about the Gordy thing. Now, every time they said nope in the film, I was that meme of people being like, when they say the title in the movie, because it was the perfect title for this movie.
I was like, oh.
And when you see it, you'll know why they called it that. You know?
I laughed whenever he would say, usually it was Daniel Kaluuya who would say nope.
He's amazing.
Yeah, he was perfect. Kiki was perfect. Newcomer Brandon Perea was perfect.
And hot.
Well, yeah, I knew that was what you were going to say to me after the movie. Absolutely.
You know what I loved? That he was like a short king giving off really hot energy, which of course we aspire.
Was it short king summer for you?
It was short king spring.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know what summer is.
All right. Well, listen, it's been a Sondheim summer in New York. I think that's another thing we could say.
Wow.
For a brief shining moment, we had two Sondheim revivals on Broadway directed by women.
Wow.
One of which won 5 Tony Awards, I want to say. It was the winningest musical at the Tonys this past year. And, I mean, we've been obsessed since we saw it in March 2020. We saw, like, the third preview.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Rain was not involved yet. Rain has been what everyone's talking about on Twitter, the rain of it all.
I know. I wonder if our guest has seen the discourse. I love... Okay, we'll actually get into it.
Yeah.
I want to get into it.
But, of course, we chatted with Matt Doyle, pre-company. We chatted with Jen Samard during, like, in the ramp-up of the Tonys campaign. And now we have sort of an exit interview.
Wow.
Have you today with one of... As they're called, the boyfriends.
One of the boyfriends. One of Broadway's boyfriends.
And
one of Bobby's boyfriends.
Yes, and his name is also Bobby.
I'm getting confused.
I wonder if that was that ever weird. I mean, okay, we can talk about it. what? Bobby? Oh, yeah, hey. Okay. Let's get into it.
I'm ready. So our guest today, Dylan, he is one of Broadway's freshest talents, a heartthrob, who most recently appeared as PJ in the Tony Award-winning revival of Stephen Sondheim's Company. Before singing Another 100 People on The Great Bright Way, he made his mark as the leading man, Calogero, in the musical version of A Bronx Tale, which was his Broadway debut. Audiences will recognize our guest from My Fair Lady at Bay Street Theater, starting here, starting now at the York, Grease at Paper Mill Playhouse, and his 3 seasons at the Muni, including the regional premiere of Jersey Boys, Les Mis as Enjolras, opposite Norm Lewis, and a revised adaptation of Lerner and Lowe's Paint Your Wagon. He also starred in Last Days of Summer at the George Street Playhouse, the all-male A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum at Two River Theater, and the world premiere of Ken Ludwig's A Comedy of Tenors. His film debut was in Barry Jenkins' If Beale Street Could Talk, and he's appeared on Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, The Code, Madam Secretary, and more. His debut solo album, Along the Way, is available now, courtesy of Broadway Records, and he will be performing a live concert event on August 15th at Birdland at 7 p.m. Eastern. Please welcome to drama, Bobby Conti!
My goodness, well done getting that intro out.
I'm winded.
I was tiring just listening to it.
I know, I'm like stressed.
even though we describe you as being fresh, you've done a lot.
Very, very, very lucky. Very, very lucky.
Yeah.
I have the grays in my hair to prove it.
But your haircut is fresh as well because you just chopped it all off. You're giving Idina Menzel when she bleached her hair blonde at the end of If Then in summer 2015.
Did she do that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I'll have to share photos.
She wanted to look like Jen Colella.
Don't we all?
Amen. Amen.
That's hilarious. It's so nice to meet you, Bobby.
It's a pleasure to meet you guys. Thank you. Yeah, it was the haircut was planned in the final week. My hair supervisor put me in contact with a fantastic woman who was going to donate it to a client of hers that has alopecia. So it was
sweet.
You know, I grew it. It was 2.5 years that we had grown it out. Every now and then we would cut off the dead ends just to make it healthy. But I learned all about hair products. I learned about the after shower curling conditioner cream that you put in and beard oil and all kinds of madness. And so it was nice to know that it was going to be in service of something else afterwards.
Yeah, because there was a bit of a goatee as well, right? Was it a full like little like a beard?
One of the things I've learned having never grown a beard before is that I can't grow in a full thing. Okay. I have little bald patches here below my chin and it will connect on the right side, but not the left side. And so I had to do all this weird little shaving to make sure it was symmetrical. And it was all very bizarre. I'm not a real man yet. Can't grow a full beard yet.
Now, I'm so curious. Was there ever a question about you'll wear a wig in the show? Or did you always knew you wanted to do your natural hair?
If you saw it pre-pandemic, Bunny Christie, the great designer of our show, had told me, I think, a little too late to grow up my hair. So they put a man bun wig in the back of my head. And cut my hair really short, except the top, so that the top could connect to that wig.
I do remember that.
And then when the pandemic happened, it just kept going on and on. I said, well, I'll just keep growing and see where we end up. And after a year and a half later, it was a pretty long length. So we did half up in a man bun and the other half we were letting droop down. And so it was easier just because I didn't have to put a wig in every day.
Yeah. Oh, that's so lucky. We, you know, Company was one of the only shows that I remember we were constantly reassured throughout the pandemic. Yeah. We will be opening on Broadway. Like that was like a sure thing.
And you know what? In retrospect, I'm talking to you right now where I should be heading to my theater right now. Because usually I would get to the theater about an hour before, say hello to Chris Sieber, who is on my left, and my dress roommate Terrence, who's on my immediately to my right. I put on this Company onesie that Manu Narayan organized for all of us to buy that has my name and 35 on the back.
I love that.
Usually Katrina and Itai and Greg Hildreth and I would go down and we'd warm up on the stage before half hour. So I'm grateful to be filling this time talking with new friends and not sitting alone in some way. But that's why I'm wearing the onesie right now with you guys.
Just yes.
Some semblance of security.
I love the onesie. One day when you're done with it, unless you're a very sentimental person, I'm sure it would make bank at the Broadway Flea.
Make all of $10, baby.
You know, I've seen a few people have already gotten a fine line tattoo of that martini glass. That's sort of like the
logo
for it. Yeah, I've seen some stuff online.
The creativity of Broadway fans never ceases to amaze me.
I know. Wow, just thinking about the few names that you mentioned already and the whole group that was assembled. I mean, there's a lot of talk about this Avengers of theater and Into the Woods, but also Avengers of theater. If we already have the Avengers, the Justice League of theater in.
Sure.
Not the movies, though. Not the movies of Justice League. The comic or the
not
cartoon.
The Snyder Cut. The Snyder Cut.
Yes, the movies are much maligned, but we'll go with like the actual, you know, the comic versions. Justice League is what this company revival was. And so congrats to you, Bobby. I feel like this really solidified you as a name on Broadway because we all remember A Bronx Tale. Con and I were obsessed with A Bronx Tale.
Yeah, well, we'll get into it. Yeah. But anyway, continue your thought.
And so I hats off to you. Does anyone still wear a hat? Because you were so incredible in this show.
Oh, that's very sweet. Now, you know, I don't feel that way whatsoever. You know, I mean, it's, you know, we were talking before this started about Rob McClure is one of my best friends in the world. He is a great advocate for someone who says you never make it. You just continue hashing it out, because that would create a sense of complacency in your mind. And it takes away the notion of how at the end of the day, we are still just so profoundly lucky to win the lottery every time we get these jobs. So maybe what it solidifies more is how is the luck of being involved in the lineage and the lexicon of this show, let alone with Steve and with George Firth, but to be a part of the history of this show is overwhelming. I got an email last night from Pam Myers, who was saying, like, she's like, I'm sure you're pretty devastated right now, but please keep in touch. She said, wrote me this incredibly sweet thing, because one of the highlights of this experience was meeting her.
Yeah.
She came to when we did this PBS documentary about the making of our show during the pandemic. And it was incredible to piece that part of history together. And because I'm a nerd similar to you guys, I knew many things already, but to learn firsthand experiences from her of how that was built out of nothing, that this role did not exist before her. She walked into the room auditioning, I think, for Susan. And they said, well, that's not going to work. And we don't know how you're going to exist in this show, but we will fit you into the entity. And Another 100 People was written for her. This scene that's truly ridiculous. It's just a person pontificating different worldviews, was just built around how idiosyncratic and exceptional of a human being she was. Mm-hmm. And to think that I'm a small part of that conversation is very overwhelming to think about. And so to be in that Justice League or whatever that's existed for 50 plus years, I think is just a testament to real luck and hopefully hard work and dedication meeting that luck.
Oh, absolutely. Well, that's so cool that you got to meet Pam and there's that connection there. I remember hearing that story once. Wasn't she like fresh out of college or like very young?
She said it was her first audition for a Broadway show right out of college.
That's incredible. Wild. Incredible. Yeah, that's really, really special. It's crazy the company's been around that long, too.
I mean, it was in pre-pandemic, it was going to open on Steve's 90th birthday, and it was going to be the 50th anniversary of it opening, because it opened in 1970.
Okay.
So there were all these celebrations constantly happening.
Yeah.
Gosh, I wish we had an official recording of you singing Another 100 People, Bobby, because it is so amazing. I mean, your voice soars.
Yeah.
And the sound design was great in the theater, too.
Yeah, we had a lot of things helping us and a lot of things serving us in that theater. It's lucky when you're part of shows that you feel like take care of you as you do it, not only in the writing, but in the design and just in the vision that Marianne had. It's all at a certain point when they showed us the sort of, on the first day, they show you a little, what is the word I'm looking for? A set fold out, a mock-up.
Oh, yeah.
Miniature version, and we're all sitting there weeping because it told the story so beautifully and fully visually that we just go, oh, we just need to stand still and speak clearly. You know what I mean? We don't have to. Many times you do a show and you feel like you have to put you're pushing a boulder up a mountain. Mm-hmm. You're trying to make something work that on the page innately doesn't. And that's the beauty of working on new material and being in the creative process, is how to make something alive that may not be fully ready and present on the page. This is already done on the page because it's been tested and proven for 50 years. And because it had been tested and proven that the concept worked by Marianne in London, we just got to step into that with our unique and fresh perspectives as the Justice League of Broadway.
Yes. we're jumping into so many things already, but we've kind of gotten where you would have been tonight a week ago. But I'm just kind of curious. So you guys closed the show on Sunday. Are you well?
I appreciate how you phrased that question. I'm a little sorry grateful.
Ooh.
To bring it back to me. That is so many of our favorite song in this production. Those lyrics every night hit profoundly, I think, more than any other one particular, at least for a number of us in that building, because it was traumatic for so many of us. But you ultimately have to let the pendulum swing back to gratitude, because A, we were a show that got to come back at all. Think of how many of our colleagues were in entities and shows pre that never came to fruition. Mm-hmm. we were the last production of Steve's, that of his writing, that he got to see on Broadway, and he held court with us after the first preview and told stories for hours and hours. And while he seemed, physically, while he, people had to make sure he was okay as he was walking, mm-hmm. he seemed as sharp as if he was a 20-year-old in the way he spoke and the way he conversed with people.
You just gave me the chills.
It's a memory that we'll try to hold on to for as long as memory serves. And so there are so many positives and so many real blessings that you have to hold on to that even when the bittersweet will eventually come in, of course, because it's closing before any of us had thought it would.
Yeah.
And it's always hard to say goodbye to a thing, but also say goodbye to a thing knowing that it's really the end. It's not like in 2020 when we were saying goodbye, but thinking, oh, we're going to come back in 2 weeks, or we're going to come back in 6 months, or I don't know if it's going to happen at all. It's realizing now it's ending, and now we just move on to another chapter of our life. It's not the be all end all. It's just the end of an incredibly emotional and beautiful chapter in all of our lives, but it's now just a continuation versus it being a real standstill as it was for everyone.
Sure.
So that dichotomy undeniably exists, especially now we're only in day two.
You're right.
Of this feeling. But I'm especially if I'm going to talk about this in public and talk about with new friends, I'm going to choose to hold on to that gratitude.
Sure. Well, we appreciate it. Was there like any sort of closing party, or how does that work with a show closing? Like, is that,
I guess it depends. From entity to entity, for us, we went to Hurley's after, yeah. And then we went to Pebble Bar, this new place that's by Radio City. But, and it depended. Some people, a quick thing I learned with this group of extraordinary people is that, especially within the principal cast, I was the only person not married with kids or living with some significant other of multiple years. I learned this on day two of rehearsal. It was on Tuesday and we finished at 6. I go, okay, who wants to go get a drink? Mm-hmm. Everyone said, I'm going home to my kid. I'm going home to my mm-hmm. And no, it's I don't mean to say no one's malicious, no one is cold. Yeah. It's that everyone had very full lives outside, and I realized, oh, and not that my life, knock on wood, isn't hopefully full, but I lead a very different daily life than everyone else in that building. So there were many people too that once the show was done, I'm going home. We said goodbye backstage. We said our comeuppance. We are lovely, respectful, inclusive people backstage, but I'm going to go off to my life.
Yeah.
Versus what did I learn from the immeasurable number of things I learned from Nick Cordero is how to go be the life of the party and create a family and a community of the people that you work with every day. And that means a continuation into the bar next door or into dinner somewhere else. Or if you go all around the country and the world together to keep that family unit together. And that's always easier to do when you're in your 20s and have no one to go home to.
Right. Wow. Oh, that's so interesting. I guess I hadn't thought about that. Having been in A Bronx Tale, it was mostly a younger cast, or I mean, half the cast was at least a little bit younger.
Well, Bronx Tale was such a weird entity because you had all these pockets of people. You had two little 9-year-olds who were getting tutored during the day. And then you had Nick and Richard Blake, who were these core veterans that knew had been around the circuit for a long time and knew how to lead a show on stage, but more importantly, how to create a family unit backstage. You had a lot of people like me in their 20s who were making their debuts, and this was a big thing. Then you had a lot of 50-plus-year-olds who had maybe stepped away from the business for a long time, but then were brought back in because these roles were so particular and unique. Michael Barra playing Jojo the Whale is like such a niche particular actor and has found profound success throughout every aspect of the entertainment world because he is so unique in his type, mm-hmm. but hadn't been on Broadway in all these years. This guy, Paul Salvatoriello, had become a lawyer and had come back. I think he had gone to like an open call and they had brought him in. And so it was these wild different pockets of people all existing in this big house at the Longacre. The Longacre is usually a playhouse. So to have a musical with 30 plus people in it, it felt like we were barging into each other backstage. So you had to create that family unit. And this is a much more adult group of people who had full lives. And, I don't think anyone in that building was making their Broadway debut. It was mm-hmm. a real set of, incredible professionals that more times than not, I was just trying to shut my mouth and listen with open ears and learn as much as I could.
Did Patty give out wisdom backstage? She's been in the business for so long. She's such an icon. Would she ever just like say things and drop little nuggets, or was she kind of just doing her thing?
I think she would, but if she did, it would be in private. It wouldn't be big group pontificating things. If she was doing group pontificating things, it was just jokes or weird little inside bits we were doing backstage. You know, something silly she'd do with Clay, Manu, and I every day during You Could Drive a Person Crazy. She would be backstage cheering her head off. But the only thing she cared about is if we could close our three doors at the same time at the end of the number and have a clean clap instead of a clap, 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 or a clap, clap, clap. And so we'd finish the song and she'd be like, that was okay. Or she's like, yes, boys, yes, that was great. But she would always say the number was beautiful, the number was perfect. Door slam wasn't great. it was every night.
Wow.
It honestly helped me doing that number, which was just many times such a bear to get through physically, to build the stamina in order to do the movement with that kind of singing. The most nervous I got was just like, can I close the door in time? Everything else became a breeze.
Yeah. Wow. That's what they say. You know, if you're working on something and it's challenging, work on something a little bit more challenging and the thing before will seem a little bit easier. So maybe that's, totally. Maybe that's like level setting for you on stage.
Gosh, I remember seeing that number when you guys came back in December again. It was like watching, you know, One Direction or NSYNC or the Backstreet Boys, like on stage, the crowd went wild. It was truly a showstopper, which is amazing. I mean, you know, you're like in the right place when you're on Broadway and this Sondheim song that was written how many years ago is getting that kind of reaction out of an audience. Like,
again, very bizarre. and you also have to, and understanding too how that song fits in the history of that show, how we were completely changing the arrangement of it because we couldn't go do 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 do. And how to fit it in this modern context and in a different vocal arrangement for three guys, and how to make the character of Bobby a part of the trio, and how we're going back and forth in this dichotomy of wanting to choke her and break her apart and then say we are so madly in love with you, and the dichotomy of how that can hopefully be hilarious for an audience.
Oh yeah, it worked so well. I mean, that three-part harmony was genius. I've seen a lot of the backstage videos and it seems like you, Manu, and Clay really hit it off so well and were just an amazing brotherhood.
I love those boys. I think it's your job backstage to create that family unit. And sometimes it's harder than others. And with those boys, it's not work at all. I adore them. Talk about people I'll miss or little bits that I'll miss every day seeing them.
I'm curious, we're the youngest guy, I guess, in the group. And how did you even end up in this show? Like, was it just an open call or was it an appointment that maybe your agents connected you? Like, I know Matt Doyle had worked with Marion Elliott before and he told us that was sort of how he got in. And
I am the casting director is a woman named Cindy Tolan who cast me in my first film. And so I think my agent was pushing to get me an appointment and she said, I think he's a little young, but I think maybe because she knew me, she said, but I'll let him come in. And so I did one appointment just for her, originally for Andy, for Clay's part. Oh. And she said, that's great. Come back for Marianne. And I met Marianne and Joel and Liam again, all doing the Andy things. And it was, it felt instantly like you're at the first day of rehearsal, like you're just beginning a collaboration versus seeing am I doing the right thing or am I giving you what you want it to say? Not, well, we're figuring out what the thing is together because neither of us know what the thing is. And then like weeks went by and then I got an email, I think, the day before I was supposed to come in for this big final callback saying, can you learn PJ instead? And there's going to be a dance call with 15 plus guys who are all in for the boyfriends. And so I show up and you see all these people I greatly admire and I've been up for other things before. And we're all just saying, all right, let's do it. Many of us, I bet we couldn't remember the last time we were all in a dance call. It was, you know, it was bizarre too. On a logistical level, I was doing a reading of a new play, a two-hander with Beth Level called Conversations with Mother that I was supposed to present that afternoon. But then I got this thing saying you need to come in the morning. So it was a logistical nightmare to figure out how I could do the dance call, be the first person that did my PJ things and be in the first combination of the trio to hear how the different voices would sound and Drive a Person Crazy. Because many of us were asked to sing different vocal parts and see what was the best blend and then run off and do this two-hander with Beth. And I think, honestly, that was maybe one of the reasons I got the job, just because I was already in such a creative mind of trying to figure out something out of nothing. versus, you know, you can ask Clay when he was there, he had to sit around for 5-6 hours while they pair people with every possible combination of the three people to see what vocal parts would work best. And I was lucky and got to get out of that nightmare.
So was Clay there that day?
Clay was there that day.
And Kyle Dean?
Kyle Dean was there that day. Jeff Creedy, Nikki's husband, was there that day, who ended up coming in and playing David for the last month of Company. All kinds of incredible individuals that you would know that I deeply
admire. A lot of different types too, I'd imagine, if they were trying a different thing.
Well, a lot of different types, but also at the same time, a lot of people that you see similarly going up for the same kind of thing, hashing this out. But what you realize more times than not when you see these people is that, well, we would all bring wildly different idiosyncratic takes to these characters. And so how can you compare each other to anything? Like, we're in such a subjective art form. So it's not a matter of who's talented or who's the best. It's just saying, are you lucky enough to happen to fit the mold that these particular creative people are trying to fill for this specific world that they've already created?
That's a
way you can really distance yourself from jealousy or ego or trying to be maniacal in the situations. Just sit there and catch up with your friends who you may not get to see in many other contexts.
Do you feel like people viewed you differently with the longer hair in auditions?
Well, I didn't have the longer hair back then. My hair was pretty short like this.
Yeah.
But yes, going through these 9 months with longer hair definitely created a different type. I was definitely going in for different roles than I had in the past. And my favorite thing is that whenever I'd walk through Midtown, I swear to you, I have been stopped more than a dozen times by strangers asking if I sell marijuana.
Wow. Wow.
And I'll, they're like, "You got any?" And I go, "No." "Do you?" So I'm like, I'm looking, brother.
Right, exactly. Because you also had the painted nails, which I see there's some remnants now.
Yes, the paint was taking a little time to come off, but all the tattoos are gone. But yes, it was like a social experiment. It was this fun thing to walk around and I feel like be a very different kind of person than I am out in the regular world. I'm a bit of a private guy. I'm pretty nerdy and dorky. And to feel like someone who considers himself the soul of New York and walks around with a great deal of confidence and probably obliviousness and a lack of self-awareness of how he's coming across and how he's speaking, but really is well-intentioned, was fun, if nothing else.
Oh, I can imagine. Well, I'm curious about the real Bobby, the guy behind all of this. And sometimes it's helpful to paint the full picture by going back to maybe the beginning or a time when you were still kind of forming your interests and your identity. And we like to call it the Ring of Keys moment, and Connor will explain it.
Right. Well, we borrowed the term from Fun Home because it's about that moment of recognition where you realize there was something within you that you saw in art and you needed to combine these two worlds and be a part of it. Do you feel like you had that Ring of Keys moment, Bobby baby?
Of course, I feel like it happens all the time. Mm. I just went with Itai. We just watched Marcel the Shell, this new movie that's out. I had that watching that this afternoon. But probably from my earliest recollection, I was a big Disney nerd as a kid, and so I would memorize these animated movies and could recite them back verbatim as a kid,
like a shadow play.
Fully, or like this wasn't a Disney movie, but do you remember the animated movie A Bug's Life?
Oh yes.
There was, if you can probably tell now, I'm a pretty odd individual. When I was a child, my preschool teachers thought I was on the spectrum. Okay. It was thought that there's maybe a little chemical imbalance because I would be doing these weird things throughout playtime. I would see these seven dwarfs up on a shelf and I would reach for them and spaz out. And so my mother, when they told her this, was like, "Why don't you come over to my home and you'll see us having dinner and maybe see Bobby function in everyday life here and if you have the same thing." And we were sitting at dinner and she said, "Bobby, would you like to say grace tonight?" And I proceeded to recite this speech from A Bug's Life that the main ant gives. He's like, "We are all connected from the grandest waterfall to the tiniest ant. We are all equal living things and deserve to be treated." So it's some bullshit. And the teacher is weeping and crying. And my mom, who doesn't know this, is going, "What is my son spouting right now? This is amazing." And then after dinner, I'm watching a movie. I'm probably watching A Bug's Life. And she hears that speech and goes, oh.
He's Flick. Just... He's Flick.
Flick. That's right. Flick was the...
Yeah, Flick. Yeah, you were Flick, right? Wasn't that his name?
You know better than me. I have not watched that movie in a good decade.
Me either, which is embarrassing. But I'm pretty sure it's Flick because we similarly were big Bug's Life fans and had all the toys.
I just remember it was better than the Woody Allen movie Ants.
Yes. Right. Yes. Which right. is almost lost to history.
You're right. Probably, mm-hmm. Probably a good reason.
For many reasons. Woody and otherwise. No, I know. Our memories are like scary good sometimes. We would do that too, where we would recite like full monologues from films. Maybe it's because we're Virgos. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm a Leo. My birthday is tomorrow, funnily enough.
Oh my gosh. Happy early birthday.
I turned 30 years old. So it's the cutting of the hair. We're beginning a full new chapter tomorrow.
Yes, totally. And your Saturn has been returning, so big changes are maybe going to start leveling out.
I don't know what that means, but isn't that a very Leo thing to not know anything about astrology except your own sign?
100%. 100%. Oh, that's so cool. I love Leos. Leos are great.
Wait, so were you 1992. Okay, yeah, because we'll be 29 at the end of the month.
And you went to Michigan.
Oh, what's up?
Yeah.
So I did go to Michigan. Basically. Go blue, baby.
Uh-huh. Go Bucks.
Yeah.
See, I was ready for when this was going to happen. So finally, when we beat Ohio State this year, it was the first time in a decade.
Yeah, in as long as I was a Buckeye fan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My freshman year was the year we had gotten closest, when we had Denard Robinson, this wild quarterback who had a cannon for an arm, but was really inaccurate, but it was a great rusher. But then we had Brady Hoke come in as our coach and was sort of a nightmare. But I left before the new Jim Harbaugh era.
Yes.
But I'm from San Francisco, the Bay, so I knew Jim Harbaugh as the coach of the Niners when Colin Kaepernick was there for that little bit and him bringing up that person into our consciousness.
Yes.
I did not even make that connection. Wow.
Yeah. So it's, you know, it's totally wild. But, you know, I mean, good for you. Yeah, congratulations on your life.
Well, listen, so you're, you know, from spent some time in Ann Arbor. Were you part of the musical theater program?
Yes.
Okay. So were you one of the only like actual people who cared about the rivalry then?
You were indoctrinated and you better care about it. Uh-huh. I think so many of us too went to the games and maybe it started to fall off as we got older throughout the season. But my tight-knit friends, you know, I lived with seven people for a majority of my time there in a house that we called Broho, who are still my best friends to this day. I'll see them tomorrow.
Yeah, I know. I was going to ask you what you're doing for your birthday.
Yeah, you know, well, I'm a big tennis player and pickleball player.
Oh, fun.
And so, well, you know, I have a whole community of friends here that are in that world, and we'll hang out and do that for a majority of the afternoon.
Oh, that's awesome.
I remember when I'd be doing my hair and Jen Samard would be getting her wig on, we'd just talk about pickleball for 10 minutes. Like, all right, have a good show.
Yeah. Oh, that's so fun. Wow. So, you know, I think you're selling yourself short by calling yourself weird, which actually, I don't know if that's a bad thing, but.
No, I say weird and odd and a positive connotation, but you know what? It's funny enough that you mentioned that. It took me time to requalify that word in my brain because I think I was told it a lot as a kid. Mm-hmm. And ultimately now you sit and go, well, why would you want to be anything else? Mm-hmm. Because my goodness, to be, if what I would hate to be told if I was ever said something I did was bland or not unrememberable, or what's the proper word I'm trying to say?
Forgettable.
So many times if people come and see my work, whether they connect with it or not, I have a feeling they go, well, I can't help but not remember you upon doing your work. Because if nothing else, your job is to create a take. This is, you know, I know we're jumping all around, but it's
okay.
Life is nonlinear, baby.
Yeah.
If I'm holding on to any mantras that Marianne would pass down, is that the way to honor the entity that you're a part of, especially if you're a nerd like me and a real historian, is to not walk in with your hands up and say, I don't know what to do, or I so revere what's been done before me. How could I possibly fit into it? Is you have to do a bold take. You have to fully own what you do. And in that way, you service what's come before you. Because if you try to do what comes before you, no one will care because it's already been done brilliantly.
Mm.
Your job is to add a new element to the equation and hopefully back it up with some literacy and some intellect and some eloquence. but then not apologize for it and say, this is unabashedly my stamp on it. This is Marianne's stamp on Company. And we do it in reverence to Stephen Sondheim. We do it in reverence to George Firth. And the way to do that fully is to create a take that is meant for people who have maybe never seen the show before, and mm-hmm. more importantly, may have never been to the theater before. Because if we don't bring in new people to the theater, this art form is going to die on the vine. It was already about to die on the vine during the pandemic. We need to build a new kind of audience. And that was a real exciting thing, is that when people knew nothing about Company and would give me nice compliments, I'm like, okay, well, now you need to go back and watch this amazing documentary in 1970 about the making of the cast recording yeah. and watch Pam Meyer sing the song, and you will understand what we are a part of.
Yeah.
And that was fun to say. Welcome to Broadway. I hope you come back to Broadway. I hope you come back to live theater.
Ooh, yes.
And the way you do that is to be your full unabashed self.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it'd be really cool to be able to say, oh, my first Broadway show was Company, you know, like that's exciting about these new audiences. The only sad thing is they probably would need to see it again. You know, it's like everyone always says you need to see Sondheim multiple times to fully grasp it. And I'm sure you were learning things through even with doing it constantly and hearing lyrics. When was your first introduction to the great Stephen Sondheim?
It was Company. It was the John Doyle actor musician revival. Hmm. I was a teenager. And I saw it on PBS on Great Performances. And so, again, it was very bizarre hearing a show that began with people singing my name. I'm in, going, what's this? All righty. And I was so blown away by it. And that led me down the wormhole and found Immediately Into the Woods, because that was a PBS recording as well. And found Sunday in the Park with George, and then found Passion. And then found Assassins and Pacific Overtures. And then we're piecing together, oh, the West Side Story I've been listening to since a child is Stephen Sondheim. The Gypsy I've been listening to is Stephen Sondheim. So, but the clocking it for the first time, funnily enough, was Company. And that's what felt, on top of many surreal things of the experience, was saying this 14-year-old kid would be losing his mind. I don't know what else that 14-year-old child could want.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? That 14-year-old child was in his dream show. And before that, made his Broadway debut working with his idol, arguably, and Bob De Niro, one of the greatest actors of our time, or person that existed, especially within that genre of entertainment, which is of the Italian culture and of the New York culture. And so sometimes it's hard to sit here talking to you guys and go, well, what else does this kid want, for God's sake? and your job is now to start dreaming new kinds of dreams, which is a great luxury and a great privilege.
Sure. Yeah, you really have worked with a lot of heavy hitters. What was do you call him Bobby De Niro? I know the people who work with him.
don't call him Bobby.
No,
but
yeah.
Bob.
Is, okay, there you go.
Definitely if you're sort of given permission to, in a sense.
Oh, interesting.
the first time, I mean, the clearest memory I have from him is that he's very particular about certain things.
And he co-directed that, right?
Yes, with Jerry Zaks.
I mean, another just incredible figure in our industry and beyond. What
was your A Bronx Tale experience like, looking back on it now?
Right, with some perspective and now, lucky enough, having another Broadway job to compare it to.
Yeah.
You know, it was very meta, and it continues to be meta now, because, I mean, you've seen that show. That show is about a young person torn between two sort of intense figures in his life, and ultimately trying to take the best of those people and making your own decisions and being able to live with your own decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Funnily enough, even though those figures want the same thing for that child, they only want that child to be safe and be loved and to kind of get away from some very dark areas of life, but they have different ways of trying to show him that. So I was being directed by two people who, as you said, are complete lore of the entertainment industry, mm-hmm. but are completely opposite in the way that they work. You know, I'm sure you've talked to people who have worked with both of them, and it's been documented for the years and years they've been out. Bob is a master of detail. It comes from mostly of a film world, and I think had done one other theater job that started at the Public. I think it's called Cuba and His Teddy Bear, and it was with Ralph Macchio. And I forget who else was in it.
The Karate Kid.
But it was at the Longacre, funnily enough. That was the only Broadway show he had done. And we were in the same theater. Huh. But he came from a completely different mindset in terms of what works on a proscenium stage. But you could argue no one understands that culture and this group of people better than this man.
Yeah.
Jerry is a master of the musical comedy, of the rhythm of language, of how if you just go diddle-da, diddle-da, it will elicit a certain kind of response from an audience. There's an utter technique to it. And he will unabashedly give you a line reading because he's like, simply say it this way and it will get the audience to do this.
Uh-huh.
Many times those are two mindsets that do not merge. And so being in the center of it, as many of us in that cast were at the center of it, you sort of parcel the best and you come out the other end of it. We were in a room surrounded by giants in every regard. You had Alan Menken and Glenn Slater writing the music. You had Chaz, whose life story it was and who I was playing, writing the book. You had Tommy Mottola, who was one of the greatest music moguls of the entire world, producing the whole thing along with the Dodgers. You had Sergio Trujillo, who won a Tony right after Ain't Too Proud. And you had Ron Mellors, who had done Jersey Boys. So it's all these icons in a room. And it was a lesson for me as a 23, 24-year-old of how to maneuver around egos.
Wow.
Of learning by example what kind of collaborator you wanted to become. Which is what we do in every aspect of life.
I'm just kind of sitting here thinking about how you were able to recognize that in the room, looking around, as you said, at these giants.
Well, I can maybe look back at it now with a little more reflection. And at the time, I was a little terrified.
Yeah, were you? Oh my God!
Because you sit there going, "Well, I want to be liked. I want to be loved. I want to be affirmed. I want to be a good soldier." And part of what being a collaborator is, and I only know this based off the experiences and people I've been very fortunate enough to surround myself with in these working environments, is learning, like any relationship in life, when to concede and plant your feet and be a good soldier, when to put your foot on the gas and challenge with respect, knowing how to just build a relationship that's out of trust and out of really being able to clock someone, not feel like you're getting taken advantage of, not feeling like you're taking advantage of someone else.
Sure.
And understanding those dynamics constantly at play. And that is something we will spend the rest of our lives trying to maneuver in every aspect.
Yeah.
And a person who is masterful at it is Nick. And I felt so lucky I had Nick in many, many facets of my life. Yeah. But he in many ways was a safeguard for me in that room to make sure that I was good and knowing that I could plant my feet when I had to and speak up when I had to, or just raise my hand when things were not clear, which is something you're not really taught at school in many ways, because more times than not, you're just taught how to be the most prepared individual to get the job. But once you get the job, how to be a collaborator is a completely different art form. And there are many different ways to go about doing it. I think we all have images of people who can be very egotistical and soak up a lot of the energy themselves and not make it a fun working environment. Because as something like Colella would say, like, we are here on this earth to take care of each other at the end of the day. That can sometimes be a tumultuous affair, but we are here to take care of each other. So if you are fortunate enough to be in a leadership position, how you can make sure we're all getting the work done in a way that is respectful and moving the ball forward, but still maintaining a sense of caretaking throughout it all.
I love that you sort of are a sponge at the same time, but you keep certain things in, you know, you don't, it's not all squeezed out of you. You maintain things. I mean, thinking about Nick Cordero and Richard H. Blake, and I know that they were incredible buddies as well through that whole process. I remember, you know, when Nick was battling with COVID and everything, the beautiful anecdotes that people would share about how he really created that family environment. And you touched upon this earlier too. I feel like it was a social education as well as a professional education when you were in that building.
I completely agree. But I think you could argue, you could look for that in every aspect of life if you choose to. And I mean, another meta thing about Bronx Tale is that Sonny dies suddenly before Colosio is able to say goodbye to him. He is not able to say his piece before he leaves. And the last text I have from Nick is that Nick and Amanda were in New York moving out of their apartment during the first week of previews of Company. We're going to come see the show. Company shut down. And I texted him up. I was like, well, our show just got canceled today. Want to hang out? He said, well, we're moving today. And this COVID stuff is freaking me out and the baby. So like, let's do a rain check. I go, okay. And that's the last thing I have. And so it's literally, I'm not able to say goodbye to this person the same way that Colosio was not able to say goodbye to this influential person in his life. It's so wild. It's super, it's spooky. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's law of attraction. I don't know if it's utter coincidence I'm not a religious person, but I don't know if it's the fear of God being instilled into you. It's, It's utterly wild. And I all I hold on to in many ways about Nick and all of these great stories everyone has heard now, luckily, is that he's a caretaker at the end of the day. It's why he was and would have been an exceptional father, because he was a great caretaker for me in so many aspects of life.
Thank you for sharing all that, Bobby. That's beautiful. I mean, you might not believe in God, but you sure believed in Flick in A Bug's Life, and that was your church as a kid. It's
theater is a church.
Yes,
we have all signed up to a life of faith. Yeah. There is very little in our control. If we wanted control, we would all go be accountants. We would all have you guys watched Severance?
It's not on our yet. List. It's a lot of people have been telling us. I know.
Guys, Severance and Itai and Greg and I love it too. It's like the show of the year.
I heard the finale is absolutely out of this world.
Unbelievable. But you need, it doesn't make sense if you don't watch the whole thing. But the construct of it is that people have resigned themselves to say, when I'm at work, I am one person and I have no memory of who I am outside of work. And when I'm outside of work, I'm a completely different person. I have no memory of who I am inside of work. And what kind of personality would draw that person to do that to themselves and make that own decision? It's not like they're being forced to do it against their will.
Okay.
And then naturally the drama that comes up within the real world and within that workplace. And if they try to collide in any means,
it is
incredible.
Yeah. And the cast is great too. I mean, I definitely, that might've been your dose of drama, but you now have to save something else.
Yeah. Okay. Before we get to dose of drama, I just want to say, we did love A Bronx Tale. You were amazing. Thank you for sharing everything about it. It was great. I still listen to a lot of those songs. I mean, amazing.
Yeah.
They're bops, baby.
There are some bops.
Yeah. And again, just one of those shows that
Alan Menken knows how to write an earworm.
Oh yeah. It's crazy that it landed in the season that it did and then lasted most of the other new musicals that opened that season without getting the love that it deserved at the Tonys and whatnot. I mean, I love a Tony nomination for a Broadway debut. And again, that was something that I really felt like should have gone to you that season, but.
That's very sweet of you to say, but that all, based off what you just said, all of it's meaningless. That show didn't need award recognition to make money and turn a profit, which is ultimately, at its purest sense, what awards should be. It's just, it should be a showcase for your show to the rest of the country, if not the rest of the world. But if you don't need awards to do that, then you don't need them.
Yeah.
And company is a thing that, especially, but so many of these shows needed it during this time of COVID, where we were grasping at any way we could share this show with the rest of the world. And so the awards were, I guess, more necessary by comparison.
Yeah.
But it was so, I had never experienced any of it. So doing the whole Radio City process was wild. Just feeling that energy throughout the entire, simply before, when we were cast, before we had even done the show pre-pandemic, there was all this energy around it. And I'm like, this is so bizarre to be in a thing that all the decision makers have pre-decided that they've liked.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Versus Bronx Tale felt like something we had to get people to get behind. Here, we didn't have to do it. We were doing Stephen Sondheim and George Firth's company for his 90th birthday, directed by Marion Elliott. Like, we got nothing to prove,
right,
baby.
Right.
It was so, but it's a fascinating dichotomy that to me makes utterly no sense. And I choose to have distance from it because I really, it would only give me a migraine trying to understand.
Sure. You know what I mean?
It's another thing that's not in our control.
Sure. I do want to talk about your solo show coming up, and I know I want to be conscious of your time as well. What's going on August 15th at Birdland?
Yeah, tell us everything.
Tell us.
Well, I mean, we had made this booking when company was still running, so that's why it was on a Monday night, because I just thought it was going to be my day off. We had, I had put out an album during the pandemic. I had recorded it just before we had started company rehearsals. It's the first time that these musicians were able to play it live since we put out that album almost 2.5 years ago.
Whoa.
So it'll be our 10-piece band, and it'll be hopefully, I mean, I don't know if you've listened to the album or not, but I would hope that there's some sort of story that can come out just simply by how this set list is arranged and placed together, just in how the lyrics can be in conversation with each other. But now being able to do the full story of that piece that I've created with James Samplina will just be super, super fun.
Oh my God.
Yeah, and the album, for those of you who can't make it, the album is so incredible. I mean, Broadway Records always nails it, but it sounds so good. the range that you're able to display on this album, Bobby, oh my God. Every single song on there is just incredible. And also, I love the title song, which Aaron Tveit sang on YouTube, and that's how I found that song many, many years ago.
Yeah, well, and it's, I also, if I have any secret agenda, it's wanting to bring out songs that may be a little less well known by people that we all deeply admire. Mm-hmm. So Pask and Paul, who are also Michigan grads and whom I've known since I was in college, I wanted to say, if I was going to sing something of theirs, as much as I love Dear Evan Hansen and I love so many of the new things, I'm like, I want to go to Edges, which you wrote when you were students at the University of Michigan and you were musical theater students and majors. Mm-hmm. And but also because if I to give some sense of what the story is about, is along the way is an experience that happened to me. I was a young person and a woman I was with said she wanted to have kids. And as a 20 something, I could not fathom even the idea of having a child. Even I don't know if I want it in the future, but certainly I wasn't going to be happening then. But clocking in a moment that, well, if I did want to have a kid, it would probably be this woman who's asking me to do it right in front of me, and having that be my first sort of adult breakup and my first sort of adult goodbye, where there are things, there are logistical things standing in the way of just fun, childish love. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And therefore how that started a spiral of how I began my first couple years in New York as a young person.
And it's pretty cool now that you're doing this at 30, you know, freshly 32, right. Like there's a lot, it's a, you know, a chapter closing, a new one starting, and oh, it's, I really wish I could be there. It's going
to
be amazing.
That's very sweet of you. Yeah. I'm excited.
Everyone else has to go in my place, so.
It's at Birdland.
I love, you know, Jim Caruso is amazing. We all wanted to be able to do it at a place that was a legitimate jazz club here in New York City. So we just feel very honored and lucky that we're there.
Oh, love it. Okay. So we're wrapping up here, but before we say goodbye, we do like to end on a dose of drama, a little something to leave our listeners with, whether it be a recommendation, a thought that's in your mind, something you want to rant about, rave about, share. And there is something that I need to share, something I'm obsessed with, a new song, well, part of a new album by Maggie Rogers, who I love.
Love Maggie Rogers.
She just dropped a new album.
Oh, really?
Oh my God. Yes, 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 yes.
She dropped it the same day as Beyonce, so there was a lot going on.
That's tough. That's,
it's really tough. I mean,
I feel like some publicist just dropped the ball.
I know.
A publicist should have been aware of that happening, being like, let's wait a day.
Uh-huh. Well, it's funny, because I don't know if she runs her own socials or if someone else does, which is a relevant conversation, I guess, today, but they've been sharing memes about like the duality of Beyonce versus Maggie Rogers, like listening to both in the same day and kind of jumping around. And it's a funny, interesting way to capitalize on both of these artists releasing new work. But the song of the album for me right now is called Anywhere With You, and everyone has to listen to it. She gave us an instant bop. So great. Maggie Rogers, love her. Gotta go listen to Anywhere With You and the whole album, which is great. And so is Beyonce's, but I wanted to, you know, give Maggie a shout out. Dylan, are you feeling dramatic today?
I am almost drama'd out. I don't have a lot going on. You've been calling me Zen Dylan lately because I've just been in a good place.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
He's Zen, Bobby. Yeah.
It might be that I upped my anxiety meds. Who really knows at the end of the day, Bobby? But
could be that.
I am looking for book recommendations. So if any listeners out there have any good books they can recommend for me to read, because I love all genres. I find myself, I've been reading a lot of nonfiction lately, which is something I never thought my 13-year-old self would ever want to do. But I've been reading a lot of biographies, things like that. But I need some things to let me unwind at night before bed.
What I was just about to recommend to you a nonfiction.
Oh, great.
Is that okay? Or do you want a fictitious book?
Yeah, give me nonfiction.
Again, I'm a big tennis player.
Yes.
My favorite book in the world, which was given to me by my one of my acting teachers at Michigan, is called The Inner Game of Tennis.
Okay.
And it's just about how to live in the moment. The tennis is used basically as a metaphor for it, but there's an immeasurable number of ways. Another thing I'm doing besides the Birdland is I'm hosting what used to be the Actors Fund, what is it now called? The Entertainment Community Fund. They're they have a golf and tennis outing every year to raise money, and I'm co-chairing the tennis tournament with Liz Callaway.
Oh, I love Liz.
The first time I did it was during the Bronx Till Days. I was invited to do it, and it was her and Steven Schwartz And you brought up Norm Lewis. I played with Norm and when we were doing that job in St. Louis, and these twins, the Nunzietta brothers. And there's a whole community. There's a whole community of Broadway people that play really well. And so that book is a big one of Stephen Schwartz loves it as well. I think I've seen, I forget it was, if it was a conversation with him and I or in some interview. They talk about how if you're a skier, for example, the way you would get better in training is you would have to increase the terrain, the degree in which you're skiing down or place rocks or mountains or trees in the way, and that's the only way you'd get better. You shouldn't be hoping, oh, I hope I hit a flat part at this time. Maybe because you need a break, but you won't get better unless you're challenged or mm-hmm. you're putting yourself in positions where you need to figure it out. Mm-hmm. Just as much in tennis, if I'm playing against a counterpart that's really not giving me anything back, I'm not going to succeed. I should be putting myself where I really need to enter a state of flow and say, I'm not going to think about the technicals of how is a ball hitting a racket in real time, strings falling over a net at this trajectory. If I think about that, the ball will go in the net. I have to just trust if I have the technique, I'm going to be in flow with whoever I'm playing with and we'll figure out what it is. And then you can extend that to if you're a creative person. If I'm in that big cattle call room for company with 15 of my colleagues who I deeply admire, I shouldn't be hoping that they go in Marianne's room and fuck up or crack on some notes or don't know what they're doing. I hope that they go in and kill it because mm-hmm. it will only force me to step up to some new level and see what I can do. Because it's all, it's not to, to wish for their misfortune is not in my control. To wish for my tennis player's misfortune for them to double fall does not service me getting better. To hope the terrain gets flat and easy does not service me as an athlete. You actually want things to challenge you because that will only put you in a position to become the more fullest person you can be.
Oh, I love it.
So that's, I'd say one chapter of I think they're like 20 in that book.
All right. I'm going to look it up.
It's one of my favorites.
All right. I love it. Thank you. I appreciate the recommendation.
Bobby, you've given us so much today. Do you have an additional dose of drama you want to share, or is Severance your,
I know I can think of another show. Severance is so good. I just finished watching The Staircase.
So good. So good.
So and so you watched that documentary before?
First, years ago.
Same with me. Mm-hmm. You know what's funny? I was doing Jersey Boys at the Muni when I watched it, and fucking Mark Ballas turned me onto it. Who I had never met. That is a talented man. Has an immeasurable number of talents that we don't even know about, and is very generous.
Wow. Were you Bob? Dude.
I was Bob Gaudio, yeah.
You're Bob. Oh, you'd be great as Bob.
That was my dream when I graduated college. I think, okay, if nothing else, I'll move to New York and I'll audition for Jersey Boys. And Jersey Boys announced its closing right when I graduated. And I said, I'll never work. I'll never get a job. And then funnily enough, I my first big job in New York was a Bronx Tale with all these people that had been involved with Jersey Boys, yeah. Same producer, music director, choreographer. That felt like a real dream come true to do that at that theater. But The Staircase, okay, so do you think he killed her or not? This is the drama.
This is drama. Something definitely happened that night. And I don't think... I think that he pushed her.
All right.
I think they were fighting or something like that happened. And then, yeah. The phone call, I mean, I don't know. The owl theory is also interesting. But what do you think?
It's for me, because the owl theory was not a part of the documentary. It was an add-on later that Mark had told me. He's like, you're going to finish this, and then you're going to find out about this owl.
Yeah.
And I loved how this scripted series worked all of this in really masterfully, I thought. It was all these different narratives were existing so fully, and Toni Collette.
I know.
And the best part of that series is seeing the different ways that she could have died, how they physicalized them.
That was my favorite part.
And it shows her technical ability as an actress is incredible, to just die in all these different, very mechanical ways. I buy into the owl theory.
You do?
Because I don't understand how she gets those kinds of marks on her head. I know that the series talks later about years later, they found another person who had been beaten to death by a club that didn't fracture the skull.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so particular. Why are the micro feathers coming from?
I know.
I guess you could find micro feathers anywhere, but that is just such a weird coincidence. Why does she have clumps of her own hair in her hand?
Right. She had to be clearly trying to, you know.
It's like she was tasseling something.
I've never seen this, and I'm in shock hearing you describe what happened to this to Toni Collette.
But I agree with Dylan that you watch the documentary first that's on Netflix.
Okay.
Because the scripted series talks about the making of the documentary.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And I never knew that then Michael started dating the cinematographer or editor of that documentary. That is skewy.
And they've taken big issue with that. Like I did a little research and her team is very upset
of,
with that.
Of course she's going to hate that that's out in the world.
My favorite scene, in addition to all of the different, like, how could it have played out type things, was the dinner at the end when they were all together at, like, a Mexican restaurant or something like that. I thought that was so good. Everyone was just delivering in that scene.
Well, and it was how, and throughout those eight episodes or whatever, how his allegiance had fallen from one son to the other.
My God, I know.
It was wild.
Yeah, so good. I could talk to you about
the whole thing. It.
And the casting was great too.
Yeah, it was that. I guess that's my drama. And so you're saying he killed her.
Yeah, and maybe, you know, thinking about it, maybe they got into the fight outside. Maybe she fell into some bushes or something. I don't know.
But she was still found at the bottom of the stairs.
Right, and then she was going inside to take a shower.
That scene where he shows the possibility he could have done that just happened in a moment, and he's choking her out, and then he realizes what he's done wrong and tries to fix it.
Yeah,
it does. You know, it seems very plausible because he's a pretty wild character. It's hard to trust him at face value because he had been lying about so many things. The fact that he had another woman die at the bottom of the stairs in another country years later is just too wild of a coincidence.
It's stranger than fiction, right?
Connor, you need to watch this thing.
There's two staircases?
You find out that years before, there was another woman that he had found dead at the bottom of the stairs.
Mm-hmm. What the hell?
And he's gay. He's gay.
So it's all real.
Yeah.
It comes out that he's bisexual, and it was a question of whether she knew or not.
Because there was like porn or something printed on his
desk. She found his Cocky Boys subscription.
Hearing Colin Firth, those scenes, he was like, yeah, I'm gonna ram you hard. Uh-huh. You're like, this is wild.
I know.
Wild.
You're selling me. I'm gonna watch it.
We'll cut this, but the scene when he ate her ass in the kitchen was absolutely wild. Like I said, I will cut this from the episode, but that was, I was like, oh, okay, we're going there with this show.
You should have led with that. You should have led with that. I would have watched.
All right. We got to let him go.
Anyway, Bobby, thank you so much for your time. It has been so lovely to meet you and to hear all about your experiences on Broadway and otherwise. And everyone needs to listen to your album and go see you at Birdland. They're going to have time because this is coming out before. So is it like birdland.com to get tickets or just on?
I think birdlandjazz.com. And yeah, it's on my... on my social media, yes. Dylan.
Yes. and you're just at Bobby_Conti.
That's right.
Okay. Everyone should go and follow you if they're not already. And of course, follow us at The Drama Podcast. I'm at Dylan McDowell. Connor's at Connor McDowell. Bobby, you're a dream. We will chat with you more soon. But until then, Connor, I will see you next time.
Drama.